Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Jeeves, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
And good evening and afternoon, depending on where you're at. And welcome to episode number 9 of the Voice of Indie podcast. I am your host today, Beam Weeks. And I do want to slip something in here at the start of the show. I am being hosted on a blog today, scribblingsofasouthernbelle.com. Scribblingsofasouthernbelle.com. I have a show don't tell writer tip post over there on Marlena Smith's blog. So stop over there, hit the like, take a read, and maybe you might learn something, or you can share something of your own in the comments to add to it. But also hosting with me today is my co-host, Stephen Jeeves. How you doing today, Stephen?
I'm pretty good. How are you, Beam?
I'm doing pretty good. It's kind of cold and rainy up here lately. I think summer's gone, and I'm kind of bummed about that.
Well, it's still summer down here, but not too much longer. I went over and looked at your post on Marlena's blog a little bit ago and left a comment for you. That was a terrific post. And I want to mention Marlena Smith is a Fresh Ink Group member, too. She's a terrific person. She's very supportive of other authors, and she's doing a lot of her own work, too. And we're glad to see Marlena helping us out by hosting Beam's blog today. Today, we're going to give away some books. We're going to give away a few copies of Operation Counterpunch if we can cajole any of you into going over to the Operation Counterpunch trailer on YouTube and leave a comment. And odds are there probably only be a few comments, so you've got a really good chance of winning a book if you want to get over there and do it. But we're trying to send more traffic to our Fresh Ink Group channel over on YouTube, where we have 60-something videos right now, more than 50 book trailers, and a lot of very cool things over there. 2 days ago, we had 91 subscribers. Yesterday, 93. Today, we're at 94. So, man, we're shooting for that 100 pretty soon. We'd like to see you get over there. So, Beam, why don't you tell them how they can win some books?
Well, like Stephen said, go visit the YouTube channel, Fresh Ink Group, and just leave a comment on the Operation Counterpunch video book trailer, and that's an automatic entry into possibly winning a copy of Operation Counterpunch, and we will let you know how to claim your prize if you are a chosen winner. So that's something you want to do. We're going to start doing that a little more often on this program to kind of reward the listening audience.
Now, they need to be logged into their YouTube account in order to leave a comment. Is that right?
Yeah, they have to. Yeah, you can't leave a comment without being logged in. So just.
But you can do that if you have a Google account?
Yes. Yeah. If you don't have a YouTube channel yourself, but you have a Google, say a Gmail account, you can go over there and log in like that and leave your comment. Tell us what you think about the video. And if you've read the book, leave a little review there. That's something that you can do as well. That'll probably up your chances of winning a copy.
During the show today, we're going to keep Twitter open, and we're going to be monitoring the hashtag Fresh Ink Group. That's hashtag Fresh Ink Group. So anytime during the show, if you want to leave a comment or ask a question of us or today's guests, go on over to Twitter and leave that, and we'll try to address that right here during the live show.
Yeah, and if you have your phone handy, you can call in and participate, ask a question, leave a state your comment. That number is 516-453-9902. Once again, that is 516-453-9902, and we'd love to hear from you.
Now, we're getting ready to introduce today's guest, and we're going to play you a commercial for his?
Well, actually, I'm going to read the bio first. We'll play the commercial, and then I'll get back with the bio.
North Korea will be the biggest challenge to your presidency, warned the outgoing commander-in-chief. But to imprisoned journalist John Jason, surviving each day in the prison camp proves the greatest challenge of his life. Protecting beautiful young prisoner Jisoo has also grown increasingly difficult for this slight man, otherwise powerless, but for his prowess at deceiving their captors. Navy SEAL Andrew Gunner Jackson is tasked by the president himself with gathering intel from the Hermit Kingdom. It's a dangerous gamble, where capture means summary execution, if he's lucky, or death the slow way in a North Korean prison re-education camp. Information is the least of his concerns, though, as the president agrees, he can leverage this mission to satisfy a few goals of his own. How far will each man go to fend off the cruel machinations of a ruthless dictator? And will that be enough for either to survive? Operation Counterpunch is ready to read now. Proudly published in hardcover, paperback, and all ebook formats by Fresh Ink Group. By Mark Marlowe. Operation Counterpunch.
Okay. Mark Marlowe has been married more than 40 years. He and his wife, Lael, have called Alaska home since President Reagan's first term. They have nurtured four children from infancy to productive adult lives and now enjoy five wonderful grandchildren. After nearly five decades in the construction industry, he spends his days with Lael harvesting nature's bounty, preparing for future opportunities to enjoy the great outdoors with family and friends, and helping to advance the human condition as grateful citizens of our great nation. So with that, welcome to the show, Mark. We are excited to have you here on Voice of Indy.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Good to talk to you, Mark.
Hi, Stephen.
So you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself, Mark?
Well, I'm just up here enjoying life in Alaska. You know, we've been here, like you said in the bio, since the early 80s, and we came from Oregon following work in the late 70s and early 80s. The timber industry was kind of on its ear in the central Willamette Valley or the upper Willamette Valley, and the Alaska Pipeline had just come online not too long before that, and was starting to pay dividends to the legislature. So those legislators had full capital projects and were bent on building anything and everything. So we came up to be a part of it. I've been here ever since.
And we understand you're retired now?
Yeah, I'm retired after a fashion. You know, I'm not contracting anymore, but we managed some real estate that we developed over the years. And there seems like when you say you're retired, it's amazing, you know, how much time you don't have.
Yeah.
So,
go ahead, Stephen.
So, what about your family? You got family up in the area too, besides Lael?
Yeah, my oldest son lives here. He's in the electrical contracting business as well, as was I. And he and his wife also operate a private nonprofit gymnastics training school and gymnasium. And my three grandchildren that are his children are all participate in gymnastics and that whole endeavor over there. And my youngest daughter lives here now. She's in law school in Oregon, but they're doing their schooling all remote these days because of the COVID. So she's actually back up here for a bit and plans to live here. She'll be getting married next June to a local fella. And So anyway, the two of them are here, and then I have a son that lives in Virginia. He works back there in the swamp, and he and his wife have one little boy that's just over a year old. And then
well,
I have another daughter.
Congratulations on that.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a nice little story there. His Greg, my second son, is kind of a penny pincher, you know. So when he signed up with his company for their health care plan, he took the bronze version because it's the cheapest. And my great-great-grandmother was a Coos Bay Indian, so we're all members of the Coos, Loramqua, and Siusla Indians down in Oregon, which makes us eligible to use the Alaska Native Medical Center up here. So Greg's work, you know, they gave him a four-month maternity leave, you know, even for the dads. You know, I don't understand how this modern stuff works exactly, but that's what they do. So he called me up and said, hey, Dad, I'm going to send Christina up here in July, and then I'll come in August just before the baby's born, and we're going to have the baby over at ANMC because you know, that's part of the benefit that George Washington arranged for by treaty to the American Indians for helping him with the British in the Revolutionary War. So Greg and Christina moved up here, and the baby was born over at ANMC, and then after things were getting organized for them to go back, then the COVID hit, and his company went total remote. So they ended up being here for the baby's first 11 months of life, which was kind of fun to have them in the house and have the baby grow up right there with us. So that was kind of fun. Anyway, they're back in Virginia now, just kind of trying to help figure everything out like everybody else is trying to do down there with this COVID business. And then I have a daughter and her husband live in San Antonio. She's a captain in the Air Force down there at Lackland Air Force Base. And they have a baby that's just turns a year next month.
So wow, there you got family all over the country.
Yeah.
They've been up to see you with the baby, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. In fact, Abby and Isaac, they went out to the moose camp this year and went hunting. Abby killed a 60-inch bull moose and brought her baby out with her. He's 9 months old, so I flew a car seat out there on the airplane and strapped it to the back of the four-wheeler and hauled him around all over the woods with us.
I bet that was fun. We do have a caller on the line that's been on for quite a while, so let's go ahead and take that caller and see who we have. Hello, caller. We do know you're from Alaska because I see by your area code. What's your name?
Yeah, I think you're talking to me. This is Ken Jelinek. I'm here in Anchorage.
Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Thank you.
Do you have a question or a comment for Mark Marlowe?
Well, yeah. Of course, I know Mark Marlowe. I've known him for, I don't know, about 12 years. And it's quite a surprise. Just with this book and with this podcast of yours, I've learned quite a bit about Mark.
And good.
It's kind of fun because, you know, I'm joking a little bit, but you look at him and you just don't see all of this creativity.
you see Moose Hunter, do you?
Well, there's other words that are probably more accurate. But so, you know, I'm calling because, you know, I caught wind of it, this podcast, and I just wanted to call and say that, you know, this is a really actually an interesting, fun, quick read book.
I agree.
It's intricate. He takes his time to build the characters. It's timely. Even though it's a few years late now that North Korea isn't as big of a of a threat. And so there's a lot of little stories that he ties together magnificently, and it's impressive. It's just fun. It's fun. It's a good book. So I did have a question, however, and I even commented on that on his Amazon page, and in my comment on that, and that is that you know, the first group that he describes, I'm wondering if there's a sequel or even a trilogy on its way to tie that in a little bit more nicely.
Good question, Mark.
Well, there is a you know, another part of the story that's coming, but the next book I'm working on is actually more of a prequel, or a sidebar prequel, if you will, and it's a story of how Gung-Ho Jackson's friend in the SEALs, Herschel Epps, comes to be, and you know, his history and his upbringing, and you know, the things that he had to deal with as a child, and then how he, you know, the kind of the story of his family history and how and everything that culminated into him becoming a Navy SEAL, and then once that is all established and figured out, and the main protagonists are defined for the readers, that is Herschel and Gung-Ho, then, you know, I have another little episode to write that I think where the two of them are involved with some more timely real life things they do together after they're both out of the Navy. So that's for later, but the next book will focus on, like I say, Herschel P. Epps and how he came to be.
That sounds good.
So Mark, so okay, one follow-up question, and then I'll let you get to other people. But so the question that came to my mind is where you got your ideas about, you know, these military operations and how you develop them, because some of this stuff, some of the strategies and the ideas are, they're not something a normal everyday person who's not involved in the military would think about.
Ooh, that's a good question.
Well, I guess the answer to the question is I knew what I wanted the, I knew what I wanted Gung-Ho to go through, and what, you know, and how he was going to come out of a North Korean prison camp. And as I developed that, and, you know, so I just thought about, you know, interesting ways to, A, get him out of the camp, B, get him, you know, rescued, C, get him finished growing up so that he was a well-rounded, you know, decent human being, and then all the things that happen in, you know, in pursuit of that, you know, those two things, I just had to develop, you know, as I went along. So, you know, I know for, you know, just by life experience that our United States military, our intelligence services, you know, is all over this globe trying to figure out where the next threat's coming to the homeland. And I can't imagine that we aren't trying to figure out, either through allies or collaborators, what's going on in North Korea or Iran or Syria or any other place where we're trying to, you know, hold back, you know, a problem. So, you know, I just tried to develop a strategy where there would be
you know, a quote unquote legitimate military exercise into trying to figure out what's going on inside Kim Jong-un's North Korea, and then let that be sort of the springboard for Gun-ho to go in and accomplish his personal goal of rescuing his mentor and his sister.
Okay, well,
that sounds pretty good. That's pretty creative, actually.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay, so does answer your question there, Ken?
Yeah, thank you very much. And I'll go ahead and sign off now.
Okay, well, thank you for calling and being part of the show.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to interrupt. Thanks, Ken. We're going to interrupt for a minute now to roll one of our commercials. This is about the latest book released by our author, Robert G. Willis-Croft. He's a science fiction and adventure thriller writer who's got several series coming out of Fresh Ink Group right now. And this is the first book in the Oort Chronicles series, Icicle, a Tensor Matrix. Want to roll it, Beam?
Sure.
Now, introducing book one in the new series by master sci-fi storyteller Robert G. Willis-Croft, Icicle, a Tensor Matrix, the first Oort Chronicle. Dying of prostate cancer, wealthy entrepreneur Braxton Thorpe is frozen in hopes of someday being revived and cured. That's when he discovers a threat to the entire solar system. But he has a problem. He's dead. He awakens to find himself uploaded into an electronic matrix. Exploring beyond the matrix and the larger global net, he discovers the Oort, a distributed electronic entity older than humanity, with an unnerving secret. Aliens wiped out nearly all life on Earth once, and they are coming back to do it again. The mathematical entity that is Thorpe has to find a way to convince humans of this threat, and in time to do something about it. But how? And what? Will Thorpe's carefully assembled team have any shot at saving the world? Will the Russians and Chinese help or betray? And who uploaded the cat? Icicle, a Tensor Matrix, the first Oort Chronicle, is available worldwide in hardcover, softcover, all ebook formats, and now as an audiobook narrated by Trenton Bennett, including music and sound effects. Icicle, a Tensor Matrix, is proudly published by Fresh Ink Group.
Yes, Robert G. Willis-Croft is an exceptional writer, so all of those who are into sci-fi and that those kind of stories, you'll definitely want to check this guy's books out.
Especially if you're like me, a classic sci-fi Robert G. Heinlein fan, because he's very reminiscent of Heinlein's writings. I also want to mention, too, that you heard the audiobook is coming out. That's probably going to be about a month from now before it's actually released.
Yeah. Mark, since the caller has already kind of led us down that path, how about you tell us a little bit more about Operation Counterpunch?
Well, I guess my goals in operation. You mean about the story or about the story?
Yeah, about the story itself.
Okay. Well, the story takes off with a man that was born in Korea before it was divided, before the end of World War II, and he ends up being the son of the man that is a secretary sent to Washington, D.C. to be the secretary for the first ambassador for South Korea or the Republic of Korea after the Allies divided the Korean Peninsula on the 38th parallel as part of negotiation to end World War II, or, you know, to end the Korean conflict, rather. And so while he's in Washington, D.C., the Korean conflict breaks out, or, you know, kind of flares up, I guess actually the peninsula was divided at the end of World War II, and then the Korean conflict sprung up subsequent. So when he's in Washington, D.C., living with his family, the Korean conflict springs up, and so he ends up being in Washington until he's, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 years old, I guess, and, you know, speaks perfect English, understands the culture here, has good friends here. Anyway, he finishes growing up, and he's a, you know, a smart fellow that is politically active and writes a political column, and is a professor at the Institute of Technology in Korea, and, you know, was doing his part to, you know, to help the country of South Korea, you know, expand its economic development and its, you know, its the benefit for the benefit of its citizens. And in his political writings, he is for his political writings, he's kidnapped by the North Koreans in an effort to quiet his pen because they don't like the criticism that he's, you know, writing about them every week. And they end up putting him in a prison camp to, you know, as a reward for criticizing them. And he has a fellow prisoner that is a young girl that was also kidnapped out of South Korea as collateral damage that they were. The fact of the matter is the North Koreans do indeed kidnap people that, you know, internationally that they don't like or frankly kill them if they feel like prevents damage to their regime.
Yeah.
And another little girl that is kidnapped as collateral damage when they're after another professor in South Korea, they decided to prostitute her out to a Caucasian Russian military officer, and when she turns up pregnant, why, they send her to the prison camp. So Jay Sun, the fellow that's there that was kidnapped initially, he takes her under his wing, and together they kind of survive the horrors of being in the prison camp and have the good fortune of working in the kitchen and preparing the meals for the guards and things like that. So they have a longer life span than the normal prisoner in a North Korean gulag. So the kids are born, and the main protagonist is born there in the prison camp. His name is Gun Ho. And then Jason hatches a plan to smuggle Gun Ho out of the prison camp when he's about 12 years old, and instructs him to, if he survives, to find his way to the United States and get in touch with his boyhood friend, you know, lifelong friend that he made when he was in Washington, D.C. with his father in the 1950s. And that friend of his has grown up to become an admiral in the Navy, and has the means to actually help and assist in Gun Ho's eventual return to North Korea to try to save his sister and his mentor. And you know, his road to getting back to North Korea. The rest of the book is basically just building, you know, setting up all the circumstances that will assist in getting Gun Ho in a position to go back to North Korea to do that once he finishes growing up. And when he's rescued out of the Sea of Japan, he's about 12 years old, and he's rescued by a family from Alaska who are in the process of bringing a fishing boat, a new a Pollock trawler that they had built in the Philippines, back to Alaska. And their route back to Alaska is, you know, north through the Philippine Sea and up into the Sea of Japan and up through the gap and by eastern Russia, and then turn right on north of the Aleutian Chain and follow it back to Dutch Harbor, Alaska, which is out on in the Aleutian Islands. And he finishes growing up there with his new family. They suffered the loss of a child just before they found Gun-Ho, so he kind of fills a place in their heart, and his adoptive father, or his found father, if you will, was a veteran of the Navy and the Navy SEALs. And so the story is basically how Gun-Ho, coming from, you know, his birth and his terrible conditions in a North Korean prison camp, escapes, finds his way to Alaska, and as an adult finds his way back to, through the political system, to his mentor's childhood friend, who's an admiral, and then he's allowed to, after taking on a mission for the new president, to find, you know, get some intelligence of what's going on politically inside the Hermit Kingdom. He's allowed then to accomplish his own goals of going to save his mentor and his sister out of a prison camp. And that's the upshot of the story. It's kind of a fun story, and I really, really do like history. And what I tried to do is to make all the historical parts of the story accurate and just drop in fictional characters that would have fit well into real events that were occurring at the time. So that
I'd say that are occurring currently as well, because I was very impressed with how you incorporated the what's been in the news the last few years for many of us into this story.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking
too.
Because it's timely, but it's also got that historical look back to where, you know, maybe people who don't know the history of Korea will get an idea on how we got to the point we are today with Kim Jong-un and his regime.
And that's correct.
So anyway,
go ahead.
I was going to say, you had some very powerful themes that came out of that too. Democracy, constitutional human rights, freedom. I mean, are these are important values to you? You wanted to say something about them in the book?
Well, yeah. You know, like I said, I do really enjoy history, you know, all periods of history. And somebody that's not completely tied up in trying to survive day to day, will quickly realize that in all of history, there hasn't been a society really like ours, like the society that we live in, you know, even currently, or, you know, even in the golden age of wages, you know, say from right after World War II, you know, through the 1990s, you know, for blue collar workers and things like that. But even before, you know, World War I, you know, life here was pretty good, comparatively speaking, to about any other society or any other period of history. We really have it pretty good, and there's a lot of people on this planet even today that don't have it so good, that are living in abject poverty and under, you know, the boot of really harsh tyranny. And so we should be real grateful of what we have, but not be so ignorant of it that we ignore it and end up back under the boot of some sort of tyranny in the future. And we have to nurture this thing called freedom, or we will definitely lose it. And what I wanted to do is to sort of uphold, you know, the notion of, you know, of freedom, you know, the freedom that, that our Constitution has delivered to us since the Revolution, and the continuing way that it endeavors to deliver that freedom and quality of life to all peoples. You know, it certainly has had a few rocky points in between for some minority groups or even some religious minority groups, but all in all, the Constitution, when there's honorable people that are in charge of the levers of power, in this country, you know, people have it pretty good, and I'd like to make sure that it stays that way. But and then at the same time, in telling this story, trying to, you know, capture that which is precious to us in that regard, but also uphold, you know, good old fashioned values like you know, family and faith and loyalty and hard work and conscientiousness and, you know, stick-to-itiveness, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So those kinds of things are sprinkled throughout the book with the various characters that come along to influence and direct Gung-Ho's life.
I was looking at a lot of the things that you were saying about freedom and things like that too, but then after Gung-Ho's rescue, I thought you had a lot of powerful things to say about family too. Just what is a family and what are family's obligations to each other? I really enjoyed that part of the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly, a nuclear family certainly is the, I think it, you know, our founding documents in this country, the founders understood the power and the benefit to a society of a nuclear family, especially one that's working well, and tried in writing the Constitution to make sure that a nuclear family was upheld and held up as, you know, as a great thing and a beneficial thing to a society.
Okay, we are talking with author Mark Marlowe. He is discussing his novel, Operation Counterpunch. And listeners, if you have a question or a comment and would like to join the discussion, the phone line is open. That's 516-453-9902. Once again, that is 516-453-9902. And
see,
we
have a comment on Twitter.
Yeah.
If you want to read that, Bean. Verwayne Greenhoe's jumped in, and he's proud to announce his latest short story, So You Want to Be a Pantser, is now available on Amazon. Go, Verwayne.
Definitely. Okay, we're going to change gears here for a minute. A few weeks back, during episode 7, we had Robert McKenzie on discussing his book, The Chair, Volume 1 and 2. Volume 1 is out, and Volume 2 is on pre-sale, so you can go and order that right now. So remember that, and we're going to run a little commercial. So while we're running the commercial, jump on to Amazon and pre-order Volume 2.
A grand epic saga by Robert McKenzie. The Chair spans centuries, touching the lives of 22 related mothers and daughters, their stories witnessed by a simple pine chair. Resolute, strong, loving, and fiercely protective, these women must strive to pass their values to new generations in a world of racism and sexism, politics, scandal, fashion, even the rise and dominance of baseball. They live in privilege and poverty, with faith and despair, relishing every moment of love, even as they suffer abiding grief. Volume 1, Lightning, Thunder, and Glory, spans the 1600s through World War I, while Volume 2, Faith, Hope, and Love, follows these women's descendants into modern times and beyond. An authentic and uniquely American novel, The Chair conjures the very hallmarks of history, yet navigates the simple intimacy of everyday lives to reveal who and why we are. Proudly published by Fresh Ink Group, The Chair Volumes 1 and 2 are available worldwide in jacketed keepsake hardcover edition, handy softcover, and all major ebook formats from Kindle to Nook, Kobo, Google Play, iTunes, and more. Everybody sits, so find your own seat and discover The Chair.
Yeah, like I said, The Chair 1 is available. If you don't have it, grab it and go over and pre-order Volume 2. And here's something really cool. Supermodel Kathy Ireland bought the book, read it on a plane trip, and tweeted about it. So that's a boost to Robert McKenzie and his book. And if she liked it, you probably will too.
Yeah, I need an address to send her my latest book.
If you're listening, Kathy.
So, Mark, are you getting good feedback from readers?
You know, sure. The ones that I know of that have purchased the book, you know, I've had several friends buy it and several family members. I have a big extended family. Something like 22 first cousins and, you know, the aunts and uncles that go with those. And so one aunt in particular that lives down in Oregon bought it and, you know, thought it was wonderful and called me and said so. So, yeah, you know, I think people that have read it and have talked to me have certainly enjoyed it. And I enjoyed writing it. So I guess, you know, I'm not a very objective critic, I suppose, but
well, you said something important there. You enjoyed writing it, and that's
yeah.
I think that's the most important of all.
I agree. And I kind of have a question. You enjoyed writing it. Have you been a writer for a long time, or is this something that you've just recently taken up?
No, I have not. Never been a writer. I've never. I didn't even know where to start exactly, or the format to put things in. So that was really fortunate for me to, you know, I had the story kind of fleshed out and written out, but to put it into a format that was certainly helpful, to have the Fresh Ink Group help me get all that figured out. But I'm a quick learner, but no, I've never been a writer, never really been, a man of letters. You know, I was in my career, I was in the construction industry, never really went to college. So, you know, it's not been in my wheelhouse, but, you know, I had an idea of what I wanted to do for another book. And that I'm accomplishing that goal in this second one that I'm writing, this that expands on the life of Herschel P. Epps. But as I thought about that, you know, it just kind of tumbled to me how to set the table to write the second book. And the first book turned out to be pretty good in its own right. And, you know, what after I kind of retired and wasn't contracting and didn't have to, you know, worry constantly about making payroll for 15 or 16 people every week and all the attendant taxes and things that go along with that, and had some time on my hands. My wife and I were enjoying something on the television one evening, and I was complaining that, you know, it really wasn't worth my time to watch it because I wasn't really enjoying it. And she just sort of offhandedly said, "Well, if you don't like it, go up and write your own darn story." So
good
advice.
I just
marched up the stairs and did it.
Good advice. So you see yourself continuing even beyond this prequel that you are in the works, have in the works right now.
Oh yeah, I've kind of decided that what I'm going to do is just write a novel that and dedicate it to, you know, this first one's dedicated to my oldest grandson, or I don't know if that's the right word, dedicated, but
sure, yeah.
But you know. Now I have 5 grandchildren, so I gotta write at least 5.
And tell the kids to slow down, huh? Well, I'm fascinated by Alaska and where you live. Now, I've dropped out a couple of times during this show, so if I ask something that was already answered, forgive me. But where exactly in Alaska are you, and is that accessible? Is that someplace we could drive to? We got to fly in? What's it like up there?
You know, I live in Anchorage, Alaska, which is in what they call South Central, right sort of in the middle at the bottom, right, you know, in the north, right. In fact, the longitude that Anchorage is on is the same exact longitude. We are on the same line of longitude as Honolulu.
Wow.
So
wow.
We're farther west than most people realize, but we're clear up at, you know, up in the North Pacific. And Alaska is a bigger place than most people really appreciate. I mean, just to give you guys, you know, a perspective that you can understand, Michigan will fit inside of Alaska 7 times with a little
wow.
bit left over. And Alabama will fit into Alaska 13 times with room left over. So it's a huge place. And we were, William Seward was very wise to have purchased this, you know, taken the opportunity to purchase this state when he did. Or when he committed to do it, he really didn't have congressional approval to do it, much like Thomas Jefferson didn't have congressional approval to write a check to Napoleon Bonaparte to buy Louisiana. But he knew the potential here, and he went right down and made the commitment to buy it when Russia came calling. Needing some cash to continue fighting their war in Crimea in the 1860s. But in any event, it is a huge place. And if you were of a mind to, you could drive here. There is during World War II, they built what they call the Alcan Highway, which runs, you can get to it from many, many parts of the border with Canada. In the Pacific Northwest and in the Midwest and get across Saskatchewan and Alberta and up to British Columbia. But you can drive the Alcan and it comes in into Alaska, you know, at the border between Canada. And then you can drive takes you about 12 hours probably of driving to get from the border with Canada down to Anchorage on the highway system. But, you know, we don't have very much of a highway system. There's a road that goes, like I say, to Canada, and it comes over and goes either to Fairbanks or down to Anchorage. And then there's a side road that goes to Valdez and one that goes to Seward, and that's about it. The rest of Alaska, you got to fly or float to.
I'm picturing that reality show, Ice Road Truckers.
Ice Road Truckers, so was I.
Yeah, so, they did build that. Yeah, when the Alaska Highway, when oil was discovered on the North Slope, they built the pipeline in the 70s. They built that road all the way up to Prudhoe Bay, the Hall Road, which you got to go through Fairbanks to get on it. And then it's I think it's 800 miles.
Wow.
Up from north of Fairbanks to Prudhoe Bay, I think that's correct.
So,
but it's a long way.
How long, or rather how short, is your summer season up there?
Well,
what's summer like, you know, temperature-wise as well?
Well, in South Sense, it's a little different than, you know, it's such a big place, it's different than different parts of the state. Where we are right here, we're right on Cook Inlet, which is basically just an inlet, an extension of the Pacific Ocean. So the ocean keeps our temperatures fairly temperate. You know, it probably on average is in the wintertime is 20 to 25 degrees. And then there's always a little warm spell that blows through and maybe a cold snap that goes down to zero for a few days. But it's certainly not, it's more pleasant than northern Minnesota or Wisconsin or Michigan, for that matter. But it goes for a longer period, but it is warmer here than in the wintertime than certain parts of the upper Midwest. And in the summertime, I think the all-time record temperature in Anchorage was 82.
Wow.
But usually it's about 67 to 70. You know, it's just real heavenly. So this nice weather in the summer. And right now outside, it's, you know, here we are on September 30th, knocking on the door of October. And it's probably, I don't know, 53 or 4 degrees outside and sunny. You know, we're in the Alaska time zone, so we're 4 hours ahead of you or behind you. It's just, you know, almost 5 o'clock here. So in the daylight, we still have daylight up till about 9 o'clock. You know, it doesn't get dark till about 9 p.m. now. And we have more daylight than the Pacific Northwest here up till about the 1st of November. And then we start losing the sunlight real fast, you know, as the earth, you know, turns. And so the sun on December 21st, on the winter solstice, the sun comes up about 9:45 in the morning, and it sets about 3:45 in the afternoon.
Wow.
And on the summer solstice in the middle of June, you know, the sun comes up about 2 in the morning, 2:30 in the morning, and sets in Anchorage about probably 11:30 in the evening, but it never really gets dark. The sun just dips below the horizon, and, you know, it's sort of, you know, twilight for those 3 hours.
Yeah, that would take some getting used to.
Now, up on the North Slope, yeah, it does. But, you know, I didn't ever have a problem, you know. You just go to sleep with sun in your face if you need to.
Yeah, because like right now here in Michigan, and we're getting dark at 7:45 now, which is just too early. You know, I mean, just like three weeks ago, we were still daylight close to 9 o'clock, and it comes real quick.
Yeah, and it'll really start going down hard here at toward the end of October for us as well. But like I say, we have more daylight from about the 1st of March till the 1st of November than the Pacific Northwest. In the summer months, we really do have a lot of great daylight to go out and do things. But our city is a real cosmopolitan city. You know, we have the university here and downtown, and, you know, it's a city of about 350,000 people. So, you know, it's not
big.
Any backwater type place. Yeah. We have all the things that you'd want to do here. And but it doesn't take very long to get out in the boondocks when you fly out, because, like I say, the road system is just basically where the railroad goes is where the road is, except for the road that heads over from Fairbanks over to the border. And now I hear that the president is putting forward some notion of putting the rail line from the Midwest up through Canada into Alaska, just to hook up the country. So we'll see if that comes off.
Yeah. So if I come up there and look in your freezer, would I find some salmon?
Oh yeah, you'd find some salmon. Red salmon is what I really like to put in the freezer. We have 5 species that run in the rivers hereabout. We have silver salmon. You can remember them with the fingers on your hand. We have the pinks, which are like your pinky finger, and the silvers, which is like your ring finger. And the king salmon, which is like your middle finger, and then a sockeye salmon or a red salmon, which is like your index finger. And then we have chum salmon, which are called dog salmon, which are out in Western Alaska, which is kind of rhymes with your thumb.
Hmm.
And the ones that have the highest oil content or fat content are red salmon or sockeye salmon. And they're very delicious.
That's the flavor.
And we like to catch those and put them in the freezer. And halibut, we like to catch halibut, which is a seagoing flatfish.
I love halibut.
And then, so anyway, we like to do that in the summertime, and then see if we can catch up to a moose or a bison or some grouse. Or there's where we go out moose hunting, there's a great lake that we catch lake trout in, which are,
ooh,
they call them lake trout, but they're really kind of sort of in the char family. They're like a Dolly Varden, but they're a little different subspecies.
Now I watch a channel on YouTube of a family that lives up in Alaska, and you know, they share their lives. I can't remember exactly where they're at, but they're kind of out in the country. They often have moose that just kind of wander through their front yard. They had one that came up on their front porch here a couple of years ago. They were talking about how it was leaning on the front door because the people that had lived there before used to feed it. So it would keep coming back around. Do you ever have that kind of a problem where, like, you got moose wandering through your yard, or are you too
yeah,
closer to the city?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of moose. There's a lot of moose in town here. There's a lot of moose all over Alaska. But there's more moose than you would think that actually live, that are urban moose, you know, that kind of live in town. And in fact, this spring, when my daughter daughter-in-law and son were living here, woke up one morning and there was a moose laying in our front yard, 5 feet from the front window in the living room. And he laid there for 3 or 4 hours, and they're always walking through the yard, you know, the lawns, you know, eating whatever they can pick up. And then we had in May of this year, a black bear came wandering up into our little subdivision and was poking. Our garage door was open, and my wife was in the house, but the garage door was open. I was gone, and the neighbor took a video of this black bear, and he peeked inside our garage and then walked back out and went to the neighbor's place and looked in his garbage can and then hopped over the fence and went on across into the park across the way. So we do live with wildlife right here in town too, but of course we don't hunt those because, you know, you can't discharge a firearm in town. And so once in a while, you know, a couple of times they've had a couple of archery hunts just to try to thin the herd down a little bit that's in town. But for the most part, they just get to live here and be a part of the fabric.
And that's
next
probably
thing you
why
know, they
want there.
They want a seat on city council.
Yeah, maybe so.
Did you have a good year hunting moose this year?
Oh, yeah, we sure did. We did. We go to a place out in what they call Game Management Unit 19C. The closest place is two, if anybody ever wants to look at a map, is McGrath, Alaska. It's tucked in right on the north side of the Alaska Range, right where the Iditarod Trail comes through the Alaska Range and heads off toward Nome. And that's where I've been going moose hunting since the middle 90s. And when World War II was going on, the Japanese had the temerity to take their Navy north and occupy some of the Aleutian Islands. And the War Department didn't take kindly to that. And they went out in the middle of nowhere and they built a runway and five officers' houses, a barracks and a shop. And from that, and they called it Farewell Station. And from that little outpost, they flew all the missions to keep an eye on the Japanese as they were occupying the Aleutian chain. Huh. And so they would fly out from the place where I go moose hunting and then kind of take pictures or do whatever they did and then send all that stuff to Washington, D.C. so they could formulate a plan to extract the Japanese from U.S. territory, which eventually happened, I think, in 1943 or 44. But anyway, the only thing that's left out there now is that big old runway. And so what we do is, you know, we put together, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 people usually and hire a DC-3 and take all of the accoutrements of comfort out to the woods and make a moose camp and have a good old time. So in our camp this year, there were two bison taken by people that were part of our camp that were fortunate enough to get a bison tag. And we had 7 bull moose that were harvested out of our camp. And many
7. Wow.
Sharp, and we had a lot of sharp-tailed grouse and a lot of rough grouse that were taken. And quite a few lake trout. So we
okay,
had a good
Mark, I hate to cut you off here, but we're coming up to our last minute. And the way this thing runs, the computer will cut us right off. So I want to say
okay. Thank
you very, very much for taking
thank you, Mark.
Time in your, of your day and coming on with us tonight.
All right. I really enjoyed it and look forward to talking to you guys in the future.
And
great.
This show will be available in the archive later tonight or in the morning, and we will be sharing it on YouTube and Twitter and Facebook. So we'll have the link so you can find that and share it with other people.
Very good.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Next week, we'll have Robert G. Williscroft. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll see you next time.
See you next week, everybody.
Bye-bye.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.